Welcome to Geburtsgeschichten Podcast, again in English episode today. Long-time listeners of this show know that I used to have a second podcast called Birth Stories from Around the World, where I published all the English episodes. But that podcast never really grew, and this podcast did and has a lot of listeners and downloads now. And I think that all the English episodes I recorded also deserve to be listened to more. So I am republishing all the English episodes in this main feed. And we start today with the one and only Uma Dinsmutuli. Uma has been my yoga teacher for the past decade. She is my mentor and just an absolutely fantastic, outstanding human being. And she has three very different but really amazing and powerful birth stories to share. Welcome, Uma. I'm so glad to have you as a guest on my podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me, Taya. It's an honor to be here. And any opportunity to talk about birth is a good one. So it's a delight to be here with you and to be part of this incredible project of yours. I'm honored.
Thank you. Can you introduce yourself to my listeners?
Yeah, my name is Uma Dinsmutuli, and I am a mother of three amazing beings between the ages of 27 and 17. And I'm a carer for three and four elders in my families, and I am a writer, and I write about freedom. So I'm also a yoga therapist. That's my kind of like working hat, and I read tarot, mother piece tarot only. So I do all of these things. I basically, if you put it together, I'm in service to the power of life. I'm the white faced servant of the blackest goddess there is. That's Kali, is time and life and the powers of life. And I'm especially in service to to the power of birth and Shakti. So all my books have names like Shakti in them. So I've written six books, and I work to support health and well-being of especially of women's cyclical wisdom. That's the thing I support, the cyclical wisdom of the menstrual cycle, of the birthing process, of menopause, and of the earth herself. So that's how I see myself often, as a servant of the power of rest and life and healing to awaken people's agency and power, freedom and power. And I've known you a long time, so that's nice to be here, to be talking to you here.
Yeah, I was thinking about that yesterday. We met exactly 9 years ago. That was when I first walked into one of your workshops.
Wow.
Center in Islington in January of 2016.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, it's cool.
I'll put the links to your work and all your books in notes. Let's get started with the birth stories. Uma, what do you know about your own birth and how you have been brought into this world?
Well, I was born in 1965 to an Irish woman in London. So that's part of the story. You know, she was an immigrant who came over, and it was a very fast birth. That's what I know. I know quite a lot about it because I have actually talked to my mother a great deal. My mother's still living, and she does talk about it, and she told me a number of terrifying things about it. But I know that I was born in North London in a hospital. And in those days, my mom was in her mid-20s. She was considered they used that term, geriatric prima gravida, you know, like an old mother, because she was 24. And I remember her telling me the whole process, you know. She went in and they wanted to cut her fingernails because she had fancy grandma's fingernails, castor oil and orange juice, all that stuff to get the labor started. I was very late and very fast. So my birth imprint is like my ADHD, like always late and very fast. So I know that about, that's the kind of context. But in the details of the birth, I know quite a lot about how it was, which was, it's 3 hours long. It was precipitate labor, incredibly fast. And my mom was on her own, but with the because my dad wasn't allowed in, you know, because that wasn't what was done in those days. And it was middle of the afternoon, but that she had to be sort of induced in the way that they did in those days, which was give you a big dose of castor oil. So I was like over 3 weeks late. I think I'd been meant to be born at the beginning of October, but I didn't show up until the 1st of November, Halloween, baby, you know. And she tells me, and I was like, oh, that's great. It was a great fast birth. She was like, ah, oh, sure. No, it was, you know, you came tearing out, she said. So I think there was a great deal of repair that needed to be made because it was so fast. And she actually told me, God, and I feel bad for her, the way you know, that she said, I'm sure it was like hemming a curtain, the stitching that she needed because I was so fast. Now, whether or not that's, she's a great one, you know, I inherit my love of storytelling and exaggeration from my mother. She's a very good Irish storyteller. She's from Dublin. So that was the kind of bare bones of it. Very late, very fast. And then she breastfed for 6 months, which actually in the 1960s was fairly rare. And I was quite large. I think I weighed over 8 pounds. I was quite a fat baby, you know, huge. And the pictures are of this enormous, enormously fat baby with black hair and loads of black hair. And I mean, in lots of ways, there are many positive things about it, but that's what I know about it. So it was in Kingsbury, North London, Kingsbury Hospital. So I'm a North Londoner, born to a you know, in very fast. So they get this. So precipitate labor is quite a thing because you don't really have time to kind of get together about it. And she'd been working up to the last minute, traveling in and out of town and pretending like she wasn't pregnant because she was working as a kind of, you know, sort of like a size model, you know, in the houses where you have to stay size 10 for them to fit the clothes and everything. Anyway, so there you go. That's the story.
Wow.
She did say she fell absolutely in love with me the moment that she saw me. So I think that's a very, very beautiful thing. But there was a lot of grief around. You know, when you understand your birth imprint, I think it's very important to understand a bit about that. There was a lot of grief and there'd been a lot of death and in the family and some great, great tragedies happened very shortly afterwards. So my infancy was really part of an enormous grief, actually. Mm-hmm. So like it's like you think of the birth story and then you think of the context, don't you, in which you were born. So it's politically a very volatile time. And quite an initiation for my mom, who I don't think really wanted to be having babies at all. But anyway, she had me. There you go.
All right. So going back, well, not 27, but a bit more, 28 years ago, when you conceived your first child, take us back to the Uma back then. Where were you living? What were you up to? And did you plan to conceive when you did?
Oh, bless you. What, isn't it fantastic to review these things? Yes. So my eldest son's now just 27. So 28 years ago when I conceived him, I was also living in London. I'd moved back to London. And I was married, but only just. I just met my partner, actually, who was my husband at the time. And he was conceived in Ireland. I know exactly when he was conceived. So in a very amazing place, sort of under guidance and connection with this incredible poet, John O'Donohue, who's quite well known. He's a great Celtic mystic. And he was part of our wedding. He was the priest at our wedding. But we'd connected with him and so the year before. And I was in Ireland when we conceived this child. And I knew we'd conceived the child. And I was we had no house. We lived in a tiny studio flat. I kind of specialized in living in amazing and free places in London. It wasn't exactly free. It was very cheap. And I was a PhD student. Okay. So what I was into was yoga primarily, finishing my PhD at Goldsmiths College at the University of London. And my supervisor was horrified. She was going, oh, yeah, you have to finish the PhD, Uma. And I got married. We went off to India. Like it was a massive turning point. That conception, like I knew he'd been conceived and I issued this kind of edict. I was like, no house, no baby, I'd said. I had this thing that like somehow, I mean, people give birth to babies in tents and up trees and, in, you know, on the side of the road and everything. But I had this thing that we needed a home. So, and we'd literally just, something extraordinary had happened with this house that we bought from this incredible family who'd lived there since they came over on Windrush. They were amazing, wonderful family from Jamaica. And all kinds of things happened. But it was like a kind of as if, you know, when that conception happens, I think the person holding the conception is really holding the power of the universe. Because conception has happened, and that's what the universe does. It creates, endlessly creates. So we created this child, and I finished my PhD 6 months pregnant. I couldn't wear any clothes except for a really beautiful wedding sari, because my husband's Indian, so I'd been given this big wedding sari. So there are pictures of me 6 months pregnant, getting my funny hat in the University of London, getting my PhD, and my supervisor was like, I didn't think you were going to do that, Uma. I finished the PhD in turn really fast because I was like, I'm out of here now. I'm going to go have this baby.
Yeah. And how were you feeling in your pregnancy? Because I think now many people know you from your incredible therapeutic pregnancy yoga. And you just mentioned you were into yoga back then, but I know that your practice back then looked different to what it looked
like. Oh, yes.
How were you looking after yourself in your first pregnancy?
Well, this is a great question, you see, because I've been practicing yoga since I was a kid, because one of the other gifts my mother had given me, she was that we'd watched the telly when I was little. We watched a yoga program. So I did yoga from when I was a tiny child, very traditional kind of yoga, you know, shapes and forms and quite athletic yoga. I was into all sorts of things. And my practice needed to change. And to be honest, that conception and that pregnancy completely, it was a turning point in my life, a total transformation. And knowing my son now, I see why. Like, he was coming in to just turn things around. So I looked after I was working very hard at my PhD and I was teaching a lot. I was a teacher of media studies and I was cycling around and I had a terrible accident on my bicycle and it really woke me up. I got knocked off my bike in the middle of London on the way to a yoga class and I was cycling. I mean, people who know London, I lived in the south and I was teaching up in the north of London. I would cycle through town pregnant on this bike. Oh my God, pregnant ladies, pregnant people. But cycling is okay, but just stay on the cycle path because your reflexes are gone. You know, you're open to the universe. So I got knocked off and I ended up in the hospital. All kinds of things happened and it woke me up and I was like, actually, I shouldn't really be doing this. I should be looking after this baby. And so I started going. I wasn't going to standard yoga classes. And I started going to the classes with active birth, Janet Velasquez, like the woman herself, you know, the person who founded active birth. Because I had some really good friends in the yoga world who took me aside and they were wiser and older than me. And they said, Uma, you need to connect with these active birth people. You know, you're going to like it. And I kind of didn't have any money ideas about what was going to happen with the birth, except I didn't want to go to hospital because of what I'd seen with my mother after she'd had my brother. She'd had preeclampsia and she nearly died. And so I associated hospitals and birth with a whole set of things that totally terrified me from when I was tiny. It's a very formative experience. So when I was pregnant, I was like, I don't think I'm going to go to the hospital, but I didn't. And I was also doing my yoga therapy training. So I was fortunate. I went to Janet Velasquez's active birth classes, which were kind of yoga. And I went to my yoga therapy training classes and Françoise Friedman. I mean, I was so blessed, you know, Taya, because like I was doing that course. I was training as a yoga therapist, doing my PhD. Teaching yoga. It was bonkers. I was doing a lot of things. I do have ADHD, so I can do a lot of things, but I had to sort of really, the pregnancy made me review things. And I was in Françoise's classes because she was teaching birth light yoga. And because of that, my whole special project to graduate from my yoga therapy diploma, which I was doing at the same time as the PhD, I was just into study mode. I love studying. I did a special project on yoga for pregnancy and yoga because I had the most terrible, they used to call it SPD in those days, pubic symphysis dysfunction. What with all the cycling around, you know, and for a long time I said, no, the cycling's not aggravating it. Of course it was because you're pushing down and it was. And after the bike accident and when I completed this project, I was working with other people, Ashtanga Vinyasa people who were also getting terrible pelvic girdle pain. And I couldn't walk. By the end of the pregnancy, I wasn't able to walk. I was literally crawling around in very intense pain, editing the yoga therapy magazine on my hands and knees, because I was the editor of the Yoga Therapy Association magazine, of course, you know, as well. So I learned about SPD, you know, pubic symphysis dysfunction, and I developed for myself and for the people I was working with a series of a series of yoga therapy approaches that relieved SPD, you know, pelvic girdle pain.
Yeah.
And that was what made me want to write, you know, all the books I wrote about pregnancy and yoga, because I was like, the people in the standard yoga classes that I carried on going to, I just felt they weren't attending to the pregnant body. And I was like, this isn't okay. Yeah.
So yeah.
That was quite a lot going on, but it called on me. It was like the energy of birth. The mother was like, now listen here, young Uma, you know, she was like, that this yoga is good, but like what you're doing, it wasn't really helpful. You know, I was just doing standard yoga. So I was taking all the things from the standard yoga class that felt great, particularly yoga nidra. I think yoga nidra saved my life, you know, because I was just like, you know, I was like a puff of smoke. I would have gone out. And yoga nidra and a lot of the pranayams and meditations. And then with Françoise, I learned all these beautiful, like snaky moves. And I worked with Birthlight for many years when my children were little. And I learned a lot. And I used to run all the courses. I helped them develop course materials and things like that. That was back in the day, like 23 years ago.
Yeah. So you already mentioned that you didn't want to go into hospital.
No, I didn't.
So did you hire an NHS midwife for home birth? Was that a thing back then?
Or did back then? This is a really great question. And I think it's important for people to know a bit of the history back then. So this is 1998, right? Lambeth, which was the borough of London that I lived in, had one of the highest home birth rates in the whole of the United Kingdom. The other place was, I think it was Devon, like around Totnes, you know, where all the lovely hippie friends of mine now live. So they did have really good NHS home birth midwifery teams, the Albany, for example, and the Brierley practice. But I was marked because my mother had preeclampsia. I was invited into a kind of trial during my first pregnancy at St. Thomas's Hospital because they thought I was at risk of developing preeclampsia. And they were trying to see if certain kinds of vitamin supplementation, I think it was A, C, and D, if that would actually lessen your chances of having preeclampsia, because they were actually quite concerned. So they picked out because of my family history. So I was the whole through that pregnancy, I was in and out of St. Thomas's having all these tests. And I don't know what part of the trial was on. I don't know if I was taking, because you never know, do you, whether I was taking the actual vitamins or not. But it was an interesting trial. But it really convinced me that I did not want to have the baby in the hospital. I already knew that. So I was kind of involved with the hospital trial, and I was going and getting extra scan and all this kind of stuff. I wouldn't have done that anymore. So I actually hired an independent midwife who had huge experience, an incredible woman who had worked all over the world. She'd worked in Mexico. She'd worked in North Africa. She'd worked in India. So she had a really extraordinarily global picture of birth as a natural physiological thing, which was exactly what I wanted. I kind of like, I found, and she lived around the corner from me because the place I lived had loads of home births. So I hired her and I gave birth at home in our yoga studio. Yeah.
Now, tell us about that day. How did the labor start?
Well, it was a whole slow process because my son was due, I think, around Christmas, and the labor didn't start until nearly at New Year, 29th. So I'd been waiting in and not being able to walk, able to hobble around. And my brother had come over to the United States. So it was a very slow start. And being the kind of person I am, I got a bit excited about it. I was like, yes, the labor has started, active birth all the way. So in the pre-labor, you know, when I really should have just been lying around resting, I kind of figured out a way that I could walk. I mean, I was in a lot of pain, but I kept walking. I was like, this is... So I learned a lot about what happens when you get totally exhausted and you're in pain before you start labor. Like, because I had such pain with the pelvic girdle pain. And then I'd made myself exhausted. So it went on for like, there was a lot of pre-labor. It was a first labor. So it went on for over a day, like the 24 hours of this, and then nothing was happening. So by the time I actually got into established labor, I was absolutely worn out. And an incredible thing happened that the midwife was like, yeah, this does sometimes happen because there's this middle stage, isn't there? There's there was the pre-labor, then there was this kind of active labor contractions. But then there was this big phase, which the midwife I knew called rest and be thankful. Like, I didn't go straight into transition. I literally fell asleep. I was like, I just can't do this anymore. I got fully dilated, was absolutely, nothing was happening. And she was saying, there's no point. So she went home. She put her jacket on. She goes, I'll come back when something, it's going to take ages for this. So the labor actually stopped, or it appeared to stop, but I was just tired. And my house was in disarray. There was like, people were building stuff in the house. And the only room we could use was the yoga studio, which was very special because my son's a proper yogi. He was one. So the midwife went away and I woke up and she was like, would you like a glass of wine? I said, no, I can't really tolerate alcohol. You know, she was like, just go to sleep. So I did yoga nidra and I went into this place for hours, like all through the night. And when I woke up, I knew he was going to be born straight away. So I had this like immensely rapid second stage of labor and yeah, this huge period of resting. And the midwife only just arrived. I was like, I think it's happening. She goes, no, it'll take ages. I'll come now. I said, no, you really need to run because I can feel this happening. I know what's going on now. I really loved that kind of stuff. I didn't have to push. He came out on literally one breath, just arrived, and he didn't cry. I was like, babies are supposed to cry. She went, no, they don't. And he was lying there smiling. For ages, he didn't cry. It was an extraordinary experience because all the things I'd heard about, like having to push your baby out and how they'd cry, none of that happened. And when I went back to the active birth center to tell my story, they said it couldn't happen. I said, it did. I said, I worked really hard. I got really tired out. I was in loads of pain. It went on for over 24 hours. I had this labor. I was shoving and pushing and nothing was going on. And the midwife just said, I think you need to have a rest. Or we call the hospital and we go in and they'll give you a C-section. That's what she said. That was the choice. So of course I didn't, that was not a choice for me. I said, I think I'll just see. And my mother was with me who'd had a very, and she was really anxious and angry and wanted to call an ambulance. And there was this massive, so we got her drunk. We gave her a bottle of whiskey and sent her upstairs to get her out of the energy of birth. And my midwife, who was very wise, was like, we can't have this energy here. She's terrified. Your mom's terrified. I said, of course she is, because she had a terrible experience with my brother with a cesarean and anyway, and didn't get out of the hospital for months. So that's what happened. The actual birth process of him coming out was like literally three or four breaths really rapidly. Well, one breath to get his head through and out. And then he just was born and that was it. It was amazing.
What an incredible story. And I mean, you were touching on that. If you had been in a hospital, they would have labeled you a stalled labor.
They would have done. Yeah.
And then you would have gotten a C-section or some.
Absolutely. I knew that. I had done a lot of research because I was keen on it. And my midwife was really clear. She was like, listen, you're exhausted and tired. If you persist in wanting to do this, I will call an ambulance and you'll need to go to hospital because there's, and if you do, that's exactly what would have happened to her. You're totally right. You're completely right. But what happened was I was given time. And I think a lot of, not all labors, but that particular labor, I was fit and super healthy and well. My baby was well. She was listening in. And she's like, you are tired. And so's the baby. Why don't you rest? So we had several hours of profound, deep sleep that I got into through yoga nidra. And then when I woke up, literally, I could almost feel like he turned himself around and he was like out like that. It was exquisitely peaceful, that part of the birth.
Wonderful. How was your first postpartum?
The one thing I always share about people is I'm very short-sighted. So I was determined to breastfeed. And I remember having to put my glasses on to look at the latch, you know, and waking up in the middle, you know, and just thinking one day I'll know how to do this without my glasses. But up until that point, I was it was difficult. I had a really difficult time trying to get breastfeeding sorted. I mean, I later became a breastfeeding counselor because of that experience, but I was very well supported by an incredible woman called Naomi, whose surname has gone out of my head, who wrote a beautiful book called What Mothers Do. Naomi, I think it begins with an S. It will come. Well, we can search it out later. What Mothers Do, and I think How Mothers Love. She was an incredible breastfeeding counselor I'd met at the Active Birth Center, and she came and we organized. I wanted support because I lived in a house with my husband and then visiting lodgers and all these builders and everything. And I felt very like I was the only person with a baby. You know, I felt really like my life had kind of turned around and I was still working at the art schools and the universities, still teaching. So I used to just bring my baby everywhere with me. Teja went everywhere. And I felt in need of support, but I was the kind of person who organized that. So I organized postnatal support groups in my house because I felt kind of lonely and confused, I think. It was a huge learning. And then we ended up in India. And one of the things, my mother-in-law was a monk at the time in an ashram in India, long story. And her one set of guidance to me after the child was born, my son, she was like, just keep breastfeeding, because if you're going to come to India next year, they were in the middle of nowhere. So breastfeeding was a kind of salvation. Do you know what I mean? I figured out how to do it without my glasses on. And I was like, this is the way. I love this. And I co-slept because I was like, I'm not getting up and putting that child. So I wanted him with me all the time. I mean, we now know that he is autistic, and I didn't know any of that at the time. And his infancy and the process of the postnatal recovery was very much about he had a lot of sensory processing issues. It was a difficult time. He's much happier as an adult, but it was very challenging trying to navigate, especially for the first baby, isn't it? Like that, this life that like, where was the baby going to fit in this life that I had before? Yeah, so it was a challenge. And I also was always trying to like share what I knew that had helped me with others. So I did start, you know, I was teaching pregnancy yoga and mum and baby yoga. And he went to all the yoga stuff with me. He went everywhere.
Yeah, and you can read about that in some of your books.
Yeah, I've written quite a lot about that. In Mother's Breath, I've written stories about that first postnatal period. But it turned, you know, I learned a lot.
And you shared it with the world, which is...
And I shared it because I was like, if everyone else is going through this kind of crap, it would have been nice to have read some of those stories. That's, you know, and I felt very excluded from the world I was in. I felt it was a kind of injustice, you know, and I don't like injustice. I stand up against it. And so I felt that like having had a baby, I tried to bring him everywhere, but I had to go other places because the places I was going to, they would kick you out. Like I'd go and hear holy talks and go to the yoga center and they'd be like, don't, if you come, but if you come, if you have a baby, don't come, basically. They were like, don't bring your baby here. So I took him the places I could, but I couldn't go to any of the places that I used to go. That was my life. You know, people were like, we don't want a baby in here. It's disturbing. So I figured out loads of ways to breastfeed children into silence. I always had them like, hide him under a sweater, feeding him away, bless him.
Yeah, very alienating that time. How big is the age gap between your two sons?
It's the classic 2.5 year gap.
Okay.
It's that. I was breastfeeding and I continued to breastfeed. And then as it was tailing off, I conceived Abby Shakes. Yeah. When he's now 23. So there's a 2.5, 3 year age gap. Tayja was nearly three.
Okay, how did that pregnancy go?
Well, it's a different thing, isn't it? Everybody listening probably knows, like having a pregnancy when you're looking after another one is a different thing. I got really into Ayurveda with Abhishekha. Thankfully, I found Gauri Mota through Francoise. So that was really important. I was really living a kind of Ayurvedic, taking all these special Ayurvedic medicines. And I think that really helped my support and nutrition, really. But it was, it was difficult in lots of ways because of a family situation that had put us under a lot of stress in our home because my mother-in-law had returned from India and there was a lot of trauma and a lot of difficulty. And I was caught in the middle of an extremely difficult situation around mental health. And so I was trying to defend, I wanted to have another home birth. And so that pregnancy began with great joy and delight, but was really like the journey was marked by a great deal of family and economic panic, actually. It was a space of fear and panic that we were going to lose our house. That we were living in under very adverse and difficult circumstances in some ways. And there was a lot of family conflict between the grandmothers. And I was kind of caught in the middle of it. And it was actually quite violent. Yes. So by the time I came to have the baby, I was I was quite worn out by it. And I'd had to call in like a lot of support from the NHS, actually, from my doctors, who were like protecting my mental health by creating some quite interesting conditions there. But I did, yeah. But I carried on teaching and yoga therapy and all of these things. And I was still teaching as a tutor all over the place. The sweetest story I'd like to just share, one little thing about that pregnancy, is when you've got very short legs, people may have encountered this, and you've got a very big baby, and you have an old, do you remember the old VW Beetles, the little, yes, the old, somebody had lent us one of these. I didn't have a car, and I used to use it to get to the place where I was teaching. And one morning, really quite late on, it must have been quite soon before I had the baby. I got in the car, moved the seat right back so I could fit this. He was a big baby, this enormous, and my feet just didn't touch the pedals. And I just remember ringing up. I went into the house and I called my boss, and she goes, "Well, where are you?" I said, "The thing is, my feet can't reach the pedals of the car anymore." And she didn't have kids. She was like, "What do you mean?" I said, "Because I'm pregnant." And they were like, "Oh, okay." But I was teaching in the art college, and they were actually really accommodating. So, and back in those days, unless you could get in, people weren't doing stuff on Zoom. So that's my funny story about it.
Yeah, and there was no Uber driver ready to pick you up.
No, I didn't have money for a taxi and all that kind of thing. I was like, so I just can't come in now. You know, I can't drive myself in there. It was funny.
Oh, hilarious.
Yeah.
So did you have the same independent midwife for your second?
No, this time, well, I'd run out of money at this point. things were difficult financially. But this wonderful NHS home birth practice attached to King's College Hospital. They were our nearest hospital, called the Brierley practice. I had them. They were absolutely awesome. I mean, there's a whole history about what happened to their practice afterwards. I think they were kind of witch hunted into non-existence, but they specialized in home births and births for, you know, women with addictions and with mental health issues. And I was having quite a number of challenges at that point. So I got really great support and fantastic postnatal support because of the nature of the birth. But they were magnificent.
Wonderful. So how did the birth go this time around?
It was the same place. I gave birth in my yoga studio. And in lots of ways, it was a much easier labor, classic second labor. Like, I knew what was going on. I was like, I'm not going to wear myself out. I'm going to rest and move. But because of the situation we were in, it was incredibly emotionally distressing. And just after the baby, and I think now I understand, I had quite a large postpartum hemorrhage. So the labor was, and Abby, I'd been all over the world. Like, by that time, I was teaching, you know, active birth and yoga birth. So I was doing, I just did all the stuff. And Abby was a magnificent baby. And it was, in lots of ways, a very easy kind of a birth. It was the easiest one of all three. But immediately after the birth, there was a massive mental health crisis with one of my family members. And my husband had to literally abandon me. I was left on the floor of the yoga room in a pool of blood. You know, like, I'd had a huge postpartum hemorrhage, and I kept bleeding. And it was another one of those situations where the Brierley were, and I had an amazing neighbor who came to look after me, help me. And the midwives were like, you know, we think you should probably go in and have a blood transfusion at this point, Uma. And I was like, I'm not fucking going into hospital. I gave birth at home. I'm staying at home. Now I look back, it might have been really handy to have that blood transfusion, because I was extremely ill for about 2 years following the birth because of the postpartum hemorrhage and then anemia. And I think, you know, looking back at it, you look at the emotional situation when someone's scared and frightened, I think it's much more likely that you're going to hemorrhage. And they did all the right stuff. They had the stuff in the fridge, you know, that they use. I've even forgotten the name of the drug that they use now. But like so they stopped the hemorrhage, but I had lost a lot of blood. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You were just saying that you were recovering for 2 years. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it was just anemia, because I'm not a crazy vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian since I was a child, but I used to eat a lot of fish and then I'd stop. So it was very hard for me to re-energize. And I had two children, and I had, you know, I had postnatal depression, you know. It was because when you're anemic, it's also you're depressed. So whether or not the postnatal depression was just in and of itself its thing, but whether I was, and the midwives, that you see this green color here, the midwives used to have, they told me later, they said, we used to go and see to see what color green you were because I was so anemic. And I remember the deep exhaustion. I mean, I thought the first birth I'd been exhausted afterwards, it was nothing compared to postnatal recovery with severe anemia. I used to go to get the iron tablets and the pharmacist was like, do you want to sit down? How are you even walking around? You know how mothers do. Mothers just kept on doing, and I had like my two boys on my bike by that point. I had one boy on the back, the baby on the back, and the one, and I just kept, because I had to go back to work at 8 weeks. Yeah, because we didn't have any money. And then we had two law, it was a whole, anyway, so the financial situation was the impact. It was like we were hemorrhaging, I was hemorrhaging money. So it took 2 years, basically exhaustion, depression, and having to earn loads of money because no one else in the family had a job. And dealing with, it was difficult, but the boys were amazing. And Abhishekha was an incredible baby. And I was teaching a lot, because that was my job, of postnatal yoga. So I think that did me a great deal of good. That was like a lifeline for me because I was facilitating groups. They were all community groups in my house and in a local place in the park. And I loved my work. And I would get there. And me and Abhishekha, this baby, came to all. So that was very different. By the time I got the second birth, I'd actually created what I needed for the first birth and what everyone needs, which was a community of, you know, well-connected and caring other mothers, basically hanging out with other mothers, teaching cool stuff with my amazing baby, who was just the chillest baby, because all he did for the first 6 weeks, you know, was lie in bed with me and be fed because I couldn't sit up. So I was so ill. So he had a very, very happy immediate postpartum. The first 6 weeks were fantastic. And then I had to drag myself out of bed and go back to work. There you go. I learned a lot of things that I now tell other people not to do because I had to do them.
Yeah. Well, your third child, your daughter, came a bit later.
Yes, a lot later.
Between the boys and then your beautiful daughter. When did you conceive her?
Well, I had another pregnancy in between. The eldest boy was 9 when I conceived Prayag, my youngest child. So, and I'd had a pregnancy loss literally shortly before her conception, which happens a fair amount, you know. So conceived, I sort of had an 8-12 week pregnancy loss and then pretty much conceived straight again on the next cycle. So yeah, she had 2 elder brothers, 1 of 6 and 1 of 9. And by that time I was like, I know what I'm doing. But I'd waited a long time because the recovery period after the second boy had been so awful. so awful. And I still have deep sympathy for that. I became a kind of crusader for the postnatal women who weren't getting what they wanted because I'd been through it and I could see what it was. And I had a very much clearer plan for support for myself on the third time around. Yeah. And in lots of ways, but I was, by that time I was 42. So I was actually really fit and well, but I encountered all the extraordinary prejudices and gaslighting and things that they do to women over 40 having babies. I was like, listen. And they were like, you can't have a home. I was traveling to India. You can't go to India. And I was just like, you do all the tests and discover that I'm actually fit and well and everything's fine and I will do exactly what I please. So I went to India, wrote Yoga for Teach Yourself Yoga for Pregnancy. That's her book, my daughter, when I was pregnant. So I wrote another book. I wrote Mother's Breath after Abhishekha was born when I was in that postnatal depression. That Mother's Breath came out of a need. I wrote the book I wanted. And then Teach Yourself Yoga for Pregnancy was a wonderful project that was entirely done within the gestation of that third pregnancy. It was superb. I used to do all the stuff and take all the pictures of you know, and it was wonderful. And her birth was at home, third one at home. And it was joyful because the little boys were there and they weren't at the birth, but they came back shortly afterwards. And there's something really special about having it. Felt like a bit of a healing experience.
Did you
after
have
the second birth, which was very, in lots of ways, a family crisis.
Yeah. Do you have a midwife again for your third birth?
Yeah, I had the same Briar. Oh, no, that time I went back. What had happened is some of the Brierley, the NHS midwives had set up their own independent midwifery practice by then. So I went with the same midwives, but they were no longer part of the NHS. They were part of something called South London Independent Midwives. And they were magnificent. Okay, so my grandmother was a midwife, and I have huge, huge respect and love for midwives, and I had the best care, and they were all, they were very, I was kind of like in some ways fighting the hospital because they were like, you're 42, you need to do this, that, and the other. I was just like, I've got these midwives, they know who I am, I'm well, I've got a really good support network, you can just bog off, if I need you, I'll call you. Yeah, because I was in the center, it was all in London. I was like, you know, literally 10 minutes from the hospital. If anything had been needed, I could have done that, but I didn't want to, and I didn't need to. It was a lovely birth.
Yeah, you said your boys were in the house, but not present.
Well, they went to see their grandmother, who was kind of next door, and they all came back. They actually went to watch a film called Chicken Run. They said, yeah, Mum, it was kind of weird. We went to watch the movie, we came back, and Mum was making these noises, and then the baby just sort of arrived. But it was a similar, I actually, yeah, there were places where it didn't look, the second stage, she was a little bit funny coming down, but I did a lot of nifty moves and sang a lot. And she was, that was the one thing about her birth that the midwives didn't believe. The baby's head came out and turned and she was singing. She was making sounds. And the midwives were like, what's that noise? I like, I don't know. There's this noise coming out of my vagina. And they were like, well, we've never seen, because the babies, they usually don't start to breathe until they get out and the skin is touching the air. So they all said, they came back the next day and they said, and we were checking in with each other. They said, she was definitely, there was sound. It was a voice. So if anyone listening out there knows anymore, anyone else has had babies that, like, literally before the rest of the body came out, the head was out, and it was not long, but the voice was heard. We heard her voice.
I didn't know it was that rare, because my second son did that too. He did.
Okay, there. That's why I'm here. It happened to you too. Then my midwife said they didn't think they'd ever seen that before. They thought that was new, and I was like, well, don't all babies do that?
Interesting. Yeah, my husband always says that his head came out. And my baby looked at his dad and did a little, like, noise, kind of like saying hello. And then the rest of
it was like that. It was quite loud. So there you go. Maybe we can see if there's, maybe there's loads of other mothers who've had babies that were singing on the way out. But it was quite an amazing experience. I was like, wow, this person wants to be heard.
Amazing. And did you hemorrhage again after this?
No. This time, because that was the reason the hospital were funny, like, oh, you're at risk of another postpartum hemorrhage. But when you understand the context of why people might hemorrhage, I was in a really unsafe emotional place. Like, I was scared, you know, I don't know. But the third time, no, I didn't hemorrhage at all. We were all ready for it. But, like, they kept my feet warm and the placenta came out really soon afterwards and we kept the placenta and we did all that. And I hadn't done that with the other two. Oh, no, I did keep the other placentas for the other two. You know, things go by and you forget. But yeah, I didn't hemorrhage. I didn't have postpartum depression. I didn't get anemia. And I had a lot more support. And also those two brothers were very excited about their new baby sister, who was exquisite and still is. So she was then in charge.
Amazing.
Wonderful. And I breastfed her till she was nearly four. So I've breastfed, and during all that time, I'd been training up as a breastfeeding counselor and this sort of thing. So I really, you know, I'd learned a lot of useful things, and I got to breastfeed in total for about 8 years of my life.
And you could do it without your glasses on.
Absolutely. No glasses were necessary in the end. But you know, one of those things that you don't really know what you're doing. So you have to kind of have a peer at it. And like, I was like, I've got this. Yeah. Breastfeeding was lovely. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Umos, thank you so much for your time and for telling us these amazing, exquisite stories.
Every birth story is amazing because it's a person's arrival. It's our imprint. You know, each one is unique, isn't it? I'm so glad that you're gathering them up so people can hear them. I'm always fascinated by people's birth stories. So I love to hear.
I could listen to birth stories all day, every day. For people who want to find out more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me in a number of places. Possibly the most useful place you can look is in the Yoga Nidra Network, yoganidra.org website, because there you'll get loads of stuff that I do, like yoga nidras and all the books and all the courses and things that I do. But you also, I do have an Instagram channel, which is my name, Uma Dinsmore Tooley, PhD, ADHD. So that's there. You can find me on Instagram and you can find me through a website. And and you can read my books because they're out in the world like other little babies. There are six of them out in the world. So there. And the ones I've been talking about, it's interesting if, you know, because they were written during the pregnancies and the postnatal periods, mother's breath, and which is, yes. So that's how you can find me. If you Google my name, I think you'll find me. But Yoga Nidra Network will give you all the events and things that I do. They're all up there. And I have my own kind of Patreon subscription process as well, where people get lots of Yoga Nidra every day and that kind of thing.
Yes, I will put all of that in the show notes. Uma, thank you so much for your time. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you, Taya. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a total joy to talk about birth stories with you, and I hope it's helpful and interesting and useful, and keep up the good work.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave me a review and maybe even subscribe to the podcast. Even if you don't speak German, I'll have a few English-speaking guests coming up. Two experts, actually, who are not going to share their birth stories, but will talk about birth-related topics. One of them is the American lawyer Hermine Hayes Klein, who is a childbirth advocate and a human rights advocate. And I'll talk with her all things law and birth. And that episode will come out in May. And then I also have the Dutch Dr. Koen Duello, who is a pioneer for MECCS. MECCS means a mother assisted cesarean, and we'll talk about how to make a cesarean, if it is necessary, better. So that episode is coming out in June.